This is 1A. I'm NPR's Sarah McCammon in Washington, sitting in for Jen White. Skyrocketing healthcare costs in the U.S. are nothing new. But during the pandemic, medical debt soared as people lost jobs and health insurance and spent weeks in hospitals recovering from COVID-19. Last year, the consumer finance firm Credit Karma found that nearly 20 million of its U.S. members collectively have $45 million in medical debt collections. ProPublica reporter Marshall Allen has been investigating high health care costs for years now, and he wants to convince everyone that we do have the power to fight the system. And he wrote a new book to tell us how. It's called Never Pay the First to Bill and Other Ways to Fight the Healthcare System and Win. And he joins us now from New Jersey. Marshall, welcome to 1A.
Thank you for having me here. I'm excited to be here.
Marshall, the title of your book is Never Pay the First Bill. Sounds bold. Explain that for us. Why not?
Well, it is bold, and I'm making quite a provocative argument. Americans have called the cost of healthcare their number one financial concern for year after year after year. And working Americans are actually getting hit the hardest. I tried to write the book as a how-to guide to help people understand how to read their medical bills and deal with other common problems they might have. If you talk to experts who review medical bills for a living, they'll tell you that most of them contain some kind of an error. So the first thing that you want to do when you get that bill, especially if it's from a hospital, you know, they just kind of give you one lump sum that they tell you to pay, you need to have them send you an itemized medical bill. And when I say itemized, they need to break down the charges that were related to your medical care, just like they would break down the items that you buy at the grocery store on the receipt that you receive. And you want to make sure that they also give you the billing codes. So when you go get medical treatment, they process that medical record and translate it into billing codes that they use to bill insurance plans. Getting those billing codes allows us to check the prices to make sure that they're accurate and to make sure that they're fair.
You know, one of the issues you write about is medical coding, the idea that some patients are essentially upcharged, you know, billed for a procedure that maybe is similar to what they had done, but more complicated than what they actually received. I think that's what you were alluding to just there. You know, for those of us who don't have medical degrees and haven't gone to medical, you know, coding, billing coding school,
right.
how do you decipher these bills?
Well, it does sound incredibly intimidating. I totally understand that. And it's unfair that we would have to do this also at a time when we are so vulnerable, right? We're undergoing care or a loved one is undergoing care. So just right from the jump, this is a very unfair position that the American people have been put in. But on the other hand, if you don't check the bills, you might be paying hundreds or even thousands of dollars more than you should for the care that you received. And so I encourage people, you wouldn't let someone take money out of your bank account without balancing your checkbook and checking your bank statements. So in a similar way, you can go get the itemized bill. You can Google the billing codes. And by the way, if you can't get them from your hospital, call your insurance carrier. The customer service people are really good at least telling you what was charged to your health plan. But go on Google, type in the billing code, and there's a description of that billing code. So let's talk about a really common type of upcoding, which is for a doctor's visit or an emergency room visit. They can bill those anywhere from what's called a level one bill to a level five billing code. Level five is the most complicated. They get paid a lot more for that, and we pay a lot more for that. Level one is the most simple. Well, it's very common for them just to kind of lean on those billing codes a little more than they should. Frankly, it's fraudulent, but nobody's really checking. And so they might bill a really simple, you know, trip to the emergency room for stitches in your finger as a level three emergency room visit. But a level three, when you read the description, it says that it requires complex medical decision making, and it says it requires an extended problem-focused examination of the patient. And I talked to a young woman here in New Jersey, 26-year-old woman, goes to the emergency room for three stitches in her finger. Her insurance plan's negotiated rate was almost $6,000 for those three stitches. That's almost $2,000 per stitch. And what she was able to do by identifying these codes is see that she was charged for a level three billing code. And because now we have price transparency, there's a rule that the federal government has enacted that says hospitals are required to post their prices on their websites, and they're required to post the cash price, the Medicare price, and each price they have negotiated with different insurance plans. This particular woman was able to see that her insurance plan had a negotiated rate for that level three visit of $5,800. Meanwhile, the other insurance plan was paying about $700. The Medicare price was $230. And the cash price, believe it or not, was $256. So in other words, if she would have gone in uninsured and paid cash, she would have been charged $256 for that level three emergency room visit. And her insurance plan had negotiated a discounted price of $5,800. And so this variation in pricing is the standard practice in our healthcare system. And working Americans are always the ones who are paying the most.
Why? I mean, is this malicious? Is this the companies trying to, you know, squeeze consumers as much as they can? Is it, you mentioned errors. I mean, is it some combination of both?
I believe that we have a system that has been established that allows for the exploitation of our sickness for profit. And I say that as fairly and objectively as I possibly can, but we have a profit-driven healthcare system. And while there's nothing wrong with making a fair profit for healthcare, we want to incentivize people to make a profit so that they deliver great care. But what's happened is the system has become overrun with profiteering and greed, and a normalized deviance has overtaken our healthcare system. And so we have all of these powerful healthcare players, the hospitals, the insurance companies, the drug manufacturers, the pharmacy benefit managers, all of these middlemen insert themselves between the patient and the doctor or the nurse or the other clinician, and they jack up these prices. They mark things up so much that if we could eliminate the middlemen and the markups, we would cut our healthcare costs by about a third.
A third, yeah. One listener tweeted at us, during my time working in medical billing, I've seen levels of negligence and fraud from providers, office staff, and insurers beyond description, demand an itemized bill, and question everything. It's designed not to make sense. So there's someone backing up exactly what you are saying, Marshall. We'll be back with more from you and our guest after the break.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A. Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
What happens after a police officer shoots someone who's unarmed? For decades in California, internal affairs investigations, how the police themselves, were secret. Until now. Listen to On Our Watch, a podcast from NPR and KQED.
Now let's get back to our conversation about healthcare charges and paying those bills. Now, you wrote the book as a guide for readers, but you also had to deal with surprise medical billing within your own family. What happened?
I did. So I started writing this book right before the pandemic hit in late 2019, and my own family had to deal with this problem. My dear father unfortunately suffers from dementia, and so we had admitted my dad into an assisted living facility. And while we were there, we had a couple major problems that I had to intervene and help with. My mom has power of attorney over my dad, and she's supposed to be involved in any medical decision making. And unfortunately, we had two things happen. We had a new nurse practitioner approve a mistaken auto refill for a drug, and it was a drug that actually caused side effects for my dad and made his dementia much, much worse. And my mom only identified it because she was taking care to look at her pharmacy statements. And so she could see that he had been put on a drug that he was not supposed to be on. And she was able to intervene. They took him off the drug. But that was one error. Thankfully, my dad rebounded and he was okay after that. It didn't cause long-term damage to him. But then the other problem was that same nurse practitioner had done an examination of my dad. And my mom had not been involved in this examination. She had said that there should be no routine exams done of my dad. And so we got hit with a bill for about $400. They were coming after my mom because they didn't have the Medicare information they needed to bill Medicare, and they shouldn't have had it because there should have been no examination. So in that case, I intervened. My older brother helped. This was in Colorado. I live in New Jersey. So my older brother helped. We enlisted other family members. I have a sister-in-law who has worked in nursing home administration, and she was able to give some advice. But we were able to pressure them and press them to remove that bill. And unfortunately, that's what it takes. You know, so you identify these errors or these overcharges, and then you can test them. Well, they don't always just roll over. They don't always just correct the problem. And so I think perhaps the most game-changing advice I have in this book is that the American people need to start using our judicial system to protect ourselves. We should start suing in small claims court whenever a doctor or a dentist or a hospital or other device supplier, whoever it is, if they won't treat us fairly and correct their errors and correct their overcharges, our small claims court system is designed for these kinds of disputes. And in many cases, the limits are actually a lot higher than you would think. In Texas, the small claims limit is $20,000. In Tennessee, it's $25,000. Where I live here in New Jersey, there's a court called the Special Civil Branch where you don't have to be an attorney. It's very inexpensive to file the case, and the limits are $15,000. And what happens is when you file that case, so if you follow the guide the way I've laid it out in the book, I call it the never pay pathway, okay? So you start by getting the itemized bill, you look up the billing codes, and you see if they accurately describe the services you received. Then you can look up the prices. You might be able to look on a hospital website. You can look at a website called fairhealthconsumer.org. fairhealthconsumer.org has all the amounts that insurance companies have paid for all of these different services. So you can get a price estimate and see if you've been priced fairly or not. Then you've gathered all your evidence. So you've built your case. So when it comes to filing in small claims court, you know how you have been taken advantage of. You can document it. You can show it. And when you file that case, think about what happens on the other side of that. So now the hospital has to probably hire their own attorney to defend themselves at great expense to them for a case where you have been actually doing very little expense and effort to file the case on your end. So what it does is it creates the incentive for them to come to the table and treat us fairly. They don't want to pay attorneys hundreds of dollars an hour to keep price gouging us. And so we unfortunately have to give them the incentive that they need to treat us fairly. And I think small claims court is a really effective way to do it.
Would that have been your next step in this case had the primary care network not backed down?
That was my next step. And while small claims court is really easy, in other words, you gather the data, you gather the evidence, you can file the case online for about $30. It is very stressful, right? It is very uncertain, and it causes a lot of anxiety. So I didn't want to have to do that. But my mom, I believe that she was prepared to do that. In fact, I tell this story sometimes because it was my mom who first gave me the idea about how to sue in small claims court when I was 16 years old. I actually had an employer who shut the business down and refused to pay me the wages that he owed me. My mom told me about small claims court. So when I was a 16-year-old, I filed a case in small claims court. The owner of the company had to show up at a hearing against me, an adolescent 16-year-old, and the judge immediately ruled in my favor. And the guy wrote me a check on the spot.
Okay.
So that was a really transformational thing for me to see as a teenager.
Sure. But Marshall, most teenagers don't know about small claims court. And, you know, Daniel writes to us on Facebook, my wife's genetic testing was supposed to be covered, but my insurance tried not to. I called in before to confirm it was covered, recorded the phone call. I ended up getting them to cover it, but it took a lot of my time. Which brings me to, in order to fight this system, people need a lot of time, a lot of energy, a lot of resources. I mean, you're a journalist who covers this. You had a family member who's a nursing home administrator. I mean, I want to come back in just a moment and talk more about, you know, what do you say to people who don't have a lot of time or energy or maybe the same level of knowledge of the system that you have? We'll get to that in just a moment. We're talking about healthcare charges and bills. We'll be back with more from you and our guest after the break.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Hint, fruit-infused water with no calories or sweeteners. Hint water comes in over 25 flavors. The watermelon water actually tastes like watermelon. The blackberry water tastes like blackberries. Hint is water with a touch of true fruit flavor. You can get Hint water at stores, or you can have it delivered directly to your door. When you buy two cases, you'll get a third case free and free shipping. Visit drinkhint.com and use promo code NPR at checkout.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult.
Now, let's get back to the conversation with these listener comments.
Hi, I'm Alistair from Florida. 2 years ago, I didn't have insurance because I couldn't afford it for about 7 months. And I had an emergency. Medical bills went up to almost over $200,000. I have three kids. And so far, I've only been able to make $300 payments. And I paid a little bit over $7,000, and I don't see how it's even possible for me to pay even a fraction of what they're asking.
We're hearing this kind of feedback from a lot of our listeners. Thank you for sharing, Alex. Opal emails, my mom was not yet approved for Medicare, Medicaid, and was in the uninsured no man's land. She had a hospital stay and got billed directly. We were able to negotiate what Medicaid would pay. That worked for us. Paying that retail hospital bill would not have been possible. A recurring theme, Marshall, as we've been talking about, is that to fight the system, you have to negotiate, you have to go to court, you have to read medical bills and look up codes, and it's just a lot of work. And so I want to go back to the question we were sort of teeing up earlier, which is, what's your advice for people who may already be overwhelmed with caregiving or their own health issues and now have to fight this system?
Well, first of all, I want to give some specific advice to Alex, the gentleman who unfortunately is being overwhelmed with $200,000 in bills. Hospitals are required to have financial assistance policies, and especially if someone is on the lower end of the income, but even some middle-income folks can qualify for financial assistance. So, Alex, if you want to reach out to me, my website is marshallallen.com. And we can at least see if you can qualify for financial assistance. These hospitals are nonprofit organizations. They're required by the IRS to have financial assistance policies. And especially if someone is low income, they can get those bills completely wiped clean. So reach out to me and I'll see if I can help in that case. But back to your question, this is completely unfair. We spend twice as much per person in the United States on healthcare than the citizens of almost every other developed nation. This is completely unfair, and the problem isn't that we're not spending enough. In fact, we're spending too much. And people are vulnerable, so this is another reason why it's so hard to fight back. And I guess the two things I would have to say is that, first of all, sometimes getting an understanding of how the system works and demystifying the complexity of the system, it makes it easier than you think it will be. For example, I recently got an urgent care bill for my son for $250. I was able to see quite quickly, within about 5 minutes, that they had not billed it to my insurance plan the way they were supposed to. I called my insurance company. I confirmed it with them. I called the urgent care, and they were able to redirect that bill to my insurance plan. And in about 5 minutes, I saved $250. So sometimes it's very difficult and impossible. Other times it's really easy. And the second thing I would say is that some people are just not going to be able to fight back. If you're in a really vulnerable position physically, or you're fighting an illness, or let's say you're working multiple jobs just to make ends meet, this is going to be just too much. You probably won't be able to do this. And that's why I think it is so important for people like me and everyone else, maybe in your audience, who has the means, who has the time to push back against this unfair system. This is a fundamental inequity that's built into our country's way of operating. And those of us who have the means and have the time and have the resources and the ability to understand and learn what's going on, we are able to fight back. And so I look at it and I go, we have about 180 million people in this category of working age Americans who are on these employer-sponsored plans or uninsured. If just 1% or 2% of that 180 million people were to demand an itemized bill, demand fair pricing, demand the hospitals comply with the federal government's rule to post their prices, and then sue in small claims court when we don't get a fair deal, that would be absolutely transformational. And so there are a lot of people, we need to do that on behalf of the people who can't stand up for themselves. And so that's what I'm urging people to do. The book does demystify a lot of these complexities. It helps people see why they need to fight back and what they can do in the different scenarios that they face. And so I'm really trying to equip and empower people, but it is true that some people are just not going to be in a position where they'll be able to take this fight on themselves.
Marshall, you mentioned that Americans pay more for less when it comes to healthcare compared to basically the rest of the world. This has been true for a long time, and it makes me wonder, rather than fighting in small claims court and, you know, asking insurance companies to produce more documents, did you ever think about writing a book about proposing systemic change so that we don't have to deal with the system in the first place? I mean, I can only imagine that listeners in other countries listen to all of this and kind of scratch their heads because of how inefficient our system is. Why are you focusing on this problem or on this solution, which some people might argue is a small-scale Band-Aid solution to a bigger problem?
Well, our politicians and powerful people have had decades to fix this problem, and they've only made it worse. And I'm talking about both sides of the aisle. The Democrats have not fixed this, and the Republicans have not fixed this. And if you look at how they are funded by the healthcare system, the insurance companies, the hospitals, the pharmaceutical companies. They put our elected officials in office, and then they spend millions of dollars on lobbyists to influence the policy that gets made. So I think one of the things we have to come to is that our healthcare system isn't broken. It was made this way. It was made this way by the powerful people and corporations who are making a lot of money off of the status quo. And so one of my arguments in the book is that no one else is going to save us. We have got to stand up for ourselves. And this is causing great harm to the American people. And frankly, our elected officials have not made it better. And so I think I would disagree. I think this is systemic change. Again, if we had 1% of the people who are affected by this problem push back, it would cause an absolute revolution in the way healthcare gets delivered in this country. It would become so inconvenient and expensive for our hospitals and our insurance companies and others to do things the wrong way that they would be motivated to do things the right way. And so, unfortunately, it's really sad that it's come down to this. It's really sad that I had to write a book, Never Pay the First Bill, and Other Ways to Fight the Healthcare System and Win, because our, like you said, to other countries, our healthcare system is a laughingstock. We spend so much, and yet so many Americans are still on high deductible plans where they spend the first $3,000, $5,000, $10,000 out of their hard-earned income to pay their medical bills. They're effectively uninsured, and we have tens of millions who are still uninsured. So I think we shouldn't wait for some you know, policymaker to figure out some solution. We need to protect ourselves, we need to protect our families, and we need to push back right now.
Another strategy you talk about in your book is involving employers in setting the costs, pushing back against costs. More than 55% of Americans rely on employer-based health insurance. That's according to the latest census data from 2019. How do these high costs, first of all, affect employers?
Well, employers are funding these employer-sponsored health plans. So, you know, say 155 million Americans are in these plans. This is coming out of the revenue that employers are bringing in, and it's costing employers dearly. And so this is another systemic change I think needs to be made. Employers have a tremendous amount of power because they're the ones that control the major source of income for our healthcare system. If the employers were to snap to attention and instead of passing those high costs on to their employees in the form of higher deductibles, higher premiums, reduced amounts of coverage, if they were to actually educate themselves on the way the system works, band together where they need to, maybe enter into direct contracting relationships with doctors and hospitals so they can cut out as many of the middlemen as they can. I think employers have a lot of opportunity here, and I think that a lot of them are waking up to this. And so in the book, I feature the stories of employers who have stopped doing things the same old way and have instead found the doctors and hospitals and the insurance plan administrators who will treat them fairly and give them a fair deal and not mark things up and not insert middlemen who have no value. These employers are dropping their healthcare costs by 30, 40, 50%. They're eliminating the copays and deductibles for their employees. Some of them are actually paying money back to the employees through reduced premiums and actual dividends based on the savings that they've had. So this problem has been solved by many employers around the country. And what we need to do is take those solutions and bring them to scale so that they can be enjoyed by the rest of the working Americans.
How can employees persuade their employers to do that if they're not already interested in it?
Well, I think one of the big things employers fear is that they're afraid that their employees are going to push back against them if they make any changes. And so what I'm trying to help employees see is that, yes, your employer funds the healthcare, but that is funded into your compensation. So your compensation when you get hired is based on your wages, your maybe retirement benefit, hopefully, some paid time off, and your healthcare benefits. Well, that healthcare benefit is coming out of your compensation. So when your compensation is getting consumed by these unjustified high healthcare costs, your employer doesn't have as much money to give you a wage increase. Your employer's money is going into funding your compensation, and that's getting sucked away by the healthcare system through all these profiteering schemes. So I'm trying to educate employees so that they and their employers can work together to address these problems. We really do need to work together, be on the same team, think about this problem differently, and stop expecting things to change with us doing the same thing. We actually have to engage and start thinking about this problem in a different way.
Marshall, healthcare costs were already sky high before the pandemic. How did COVID-19 change things?
I think COVID-19 exposed our healthcare system for what it is. And by that, I mean, unfortunately, we saw exposed in just devastating reality that we have not developed a healthcare system that is for the betterment of the American public. Our healthcare system has been developed for the betterment of the corporations and powerful individuals who are making a profit off of our sickness. And so we need, again, policymakers need to think about this in a different way. We need to invest in the infrastructure we need so that we can have a healthcare system that actually serves the American people instead of serving the investors and the other people who are making profits on it. COVID caused a lot of job loss, And with job loss came the loss of health insurance and insurance benefits. And so I do encourage anybody who lost their benefits during the pandemic and then got hit with medical bills, do look into those financial assistance policies. It may be that your income dropped to a low enough level where you might qualify. And I do know cases where people have even been able to retroactively go back and get repaid through financial assistance policies for the money that they've already paid for their medical bills. So I urge people to look into those if they've lost their jobs.
That's Marshall Allen, reporter for ProPublica and author of the new book, Never Pay the First Bill and Other Ways to Fight the Healthcare System and Win. The book comes out today. Marshall, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
Remember, we have a text club. We'll only ever send you one text a day. It's the fastest way to connect with us. Details about how to sign up can be found in the Ask 1A tab at the 1A.org. Today's producer was Amanda Williams. Our podcast is produced by Barb Anguiano. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Sarah McCammon. Jen White will be back tomorrow. Until then, this is 1A.